a Supreme Court justice has said he couldn't define pornography, but you knew it when you saw it. Presidential rhetoric may be of the same character. We know it when we hear it, but what is it and who has it and how did they get it is a legitimate question to think about, it seems to me. And Ted Wendt has been thinking about this hard for several decades. He introduced some years ago at the University of Pittsburgh a course on presidential rhetoric with 25 students, a one-semester course. Today it's a two-semester course, and he has 600 students. And even with academic inflation, why that tells you something about his success. He's been a speechwriter for Governor Thornburg and others, now Attorney General Thornburg. He has written books on presidential rhetoric and presidents and protesters, a subject he addressed yesterday. He was a member of the Harvard Commission on the Presidency and the Press Conference. He has been an analyst for radio station KQV in Pittsburgh, presidential analyst and political analyst. He has participated actively and vigorously in the whole discipline of rhetoric and communication, delivering papers and contributing. He received his bachelor's degree from a little college in Texas in English, then a master's degree in theater arts from Bowling Green College, and his doctorate from Ohio State University. His dissertation dealt with the rhetoric of Nikita Khrushchev. So it covers a broad span, and if anybody can help us understand presidential rhetoric, it seems to me it's likely to be my good friend, Professor Ted Wendt.
Thank you, Ken. I'm so pleased to be here. Mr. Jefferson is one of my heroes, and this is my first visit to the University of Virginia, and it has been a very pleasant one, made even more so by the great and generous hospitality that Ken Thompson has extended to me. I thought this morning that I would talk for a while and then throw it open to questions, if that's all right with you. And what I would do are two things. One, to try to answer that question, what is rhetoric, and specifically in the context of the American American presidency. And secondly, to do a thumbnail sketch of presidents from Kennedy to Reagan on their uses of rhetoric and a very brief description of what I see as their distinctive kinds of rhetoric. So let me begin with that thorny word, rhetoric, which for those of us who study it is the art of persuasion. How are people persuaded publicly? Richard Neustadt, in his book, Presidential Power, says the essential power of a president is the power to persuade. He makes no distinction in that early book between private persuasion and public persuasion. We who work in rhetoric do. And we're concerned with public persuasion. Persuasion of the public through speeches, press conferences, a variety of public appearances that the president makes. I am concerned with that persuasion in the context of presidential power. And I see now, because of television, because of recent presidents going public, as Samuel Kernell calls it, the rhetoric has become an instrument of power for the president to try to achieve his goals. Thus, persuasion, to to me, is an instrument of presidential power. The president has essentially three powers available to him. He has the legal power granted by the Constitution, law, precedent, and so on, that he can as a basis for acting. He has power, political power, through his party, and being able to work through his party in Congress to get certain kinds of legislation passed. But in a democracy, there's a third power, and that is the power of public support. And what we have seen in recent presidents who have lost public support is that their other powers have been diminished because of a loss of public support, whether it was Lyndon Johnson with the credibility gap in the last years of his administration, or Richard Nixon with Watergate and how that diminished his public support and then diminished his other powers. Because of the decline of parties and the rise of television and instantaneous communication, not only with the people in America, but around the world, in fact, the rhetorical power of going public through speeches, press conferences, and other kinds of appearances has become more crucial to the exercise of presidential power. Rhetoric, I think, consists of four basic elements, if we're going to understand it. Four things that make up presidential persuasion in terms of public appearances, in terms of speeches and arguments that the president makes. The first element in rhetoric is being able to define an issue publicly. To define an issue. Last night I attended a little seminar that was given and listened in to people talking about our intervention in Vietnam and the argument over should we intervene or not intervene, what kind of war was it, and so on. As they were talking, defining that issue became crucial to all the other arguments that were used last night, and in fact were used by the administration. What was happening in Vietnam when we decided to intervene? The administration defined it as a war of aggression from North Vietnam against an independent country in the South. We were supposed to come, therefore, to the aid of an independent country threatened by aggression from the North. Those who opposed the war later on began to define it as a civil war between, in one case, some of the protesters defined it as a civil war indigenous only to the South between competing forces, or in another case, a civil war of a Vietnam of the North and the South battling one another in a civil war for unification or not to be unified. Definition was central because all of the other arguments and justifications for policy and attempts to persuade the public came from how you define that war. In presidential rhetoric, the first and most important thing that a president has available to him in his rhetorical arsenal, if you will, to exercise power, is to define an issue. What it means politically, what it means to the country, because that's where the arguments come from. That first definition publicly of what an issue is. A corollary to that definition is also naming how important, as part of definition, how important an issue is. In other words, setting the agenda. President Reagan in 1981 came before the American people and said, we have the worst economic mess since the Great Depression. And he said, here are four things that have to be done to solve that. And thus was starting to name the issue, how important it was, the greatest economic mess before the country, and here are the four things that we need to do in cutting taxes, cutting the budget, cutting regulations, and having a stable and consistent monetary policy. Or President Kennedy, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, says there are missiles in Cuba, offensive missiles in Cuba, and defines them or names them as crisis, which sets up a psychology of how you're going to respond. If he had named those in another way, there would have been a different kind of response, but he decided to name those as crisis, and thus sets up a certain urgency to act based on the way in which the issue has been defined. This is central, I would argue, to the use of presidential power, the ability to name and define an issue. And because the president has the opportunity to go to the American people first through a nationally televised speech, he can set the terms of the argument, and the rest of our arguments and even policies proceed from the way in which an issue is defined by the president. No other politician has the power to define an issue for the American people the way in which a president does, because of the uniqueness of the presidential office. The second element that makes up rhetoric, presidential rhetoric, are arguments that presidents typically use to support their contentions, their definitions of issues. Let me just cite a few of those, not extensively, but to illustrate my point. First, argument from historical analogy. Presidents persistently use arguments from historical analogy. Last night, as we were talking again, the Munich analogy came up. You've got to stop communism in Southeast Asia. And the reason for that, one of the arguments made by Lyndon Johnson was that this was comparable to the Munich, to what happened at Munich, and to avoiding that, not having appeasement in Southeast Asia as there was appeasement at Munich, and therefore we have to take our stand here or else the dominoes will fall as they did in World War II. So the argument from historical analogy. Argument, secondly, from authority. The president has certain authorities and therefore can argue from them, and you'll see in major speeches the president citing authorities, particularly in controversial areas in foreign policy, of citing his authority to act in the speech. Third, argument from consequences, and that's standard all political rhetoric. Whether it be president or another politician, they will argue, and I've written some speeches that do this, that if you do what I want done, the consequences will be great for the American people or for whomever we're trying to persuade. If you follow the contrary, it will create terrible consequences for America. Argument for consequences is just standard in political rhetoric, certainly in campaigns, where electing my candidate will bring in an era of prosperity, peace, and so forth, and electing the other candidate will mean the end of Western civilization. Hyperbole is a stylistic device that is endemic to political campaign rhetoric. Fourth, argument from metaphor, which works very much like argument from historical analogy. In fact, I find it sometimes difficult to separate the Munich analogy from the domino theory, which is the metaphor from it, because they work together. If you appease, then, or if you have a moment of appeasement, then the dominoes are gonna fall because you didn't stand up at that moment. Finally, more argument from political maxims that we seem to believe, such as majority rules. And over again, presidents will say, we're doing this because the president represents the majority, and the people who oppose him represent the minority, and it draws upon that political maxim that we believe in, majority rules. Third form of argument or element that makes up political rhetoric is what we technically call ethos, using the Greek word. What we mean by that is the character, personality of the speaker himself, in the case of the president, but also the perception of that person and the qualities that a president that are conferred upon the president by the very nature of holding office. It's what some of us call the Teddy White syndrome. If you've read the Making of the President series, notice in the last chapter of each one of those, when someone wins the presidency, all of a sudden they become enormously intelligent. And Teddy White does this last chapter on how they've taken on a different character now that they're president. He becomes somewhat awestruck. And I have to admit, I share that. I haven't met but one president directly, and that was Gerry Ford. And I was awestruck just sitting down, I had an interview with him for television, a 30-minute interview. And after when the interview played that weekend, I called him Mr. President so many times it became boring and repetitive. But it was awesome to be there with a former president of the United States and to interview him. And there is that aura about the presidency that a president can draw upon. You see it expressed in many of the letters to editors supporting the president, in which people will give no other argument other than the president knows best. Or this is the president's policy. Why are you people not supporting the president? You are attacking the president. This is an argument from ethos itself. I would argue further in this kind of argument that there is, we've seen it recently in the Tower confirmation debates, with the president and his supporters saying there is a presidential prerogative to have his people serving him, and Congress should, or in this case, the Senate, should not intervene. And here's the argument from presidential prerogative. The other argument was, of course, the argument from the Senate and the opposition saying, here is senatorial prerogative for advice and consent on this, and we're not going to consent. But it was argument from the ethos of the office on the president's side of the prerogative of the president. Finally, the third part of this, or the fourth part, excuse me, is adaptation to the audience. Ronald Reagan was very good for rhetoricians. Gerry Ford and Jimmy Carter were not. Because during the years of Ford and Carter, I rarely got called up to analyze a scintillating speech by either one of them until the Malay speech in 1979. Once Ronald Reagan got in office, people were calling all of the time asking what makes the great communicator work. And I got a lot of extra work during the Reagan years. I miss him very much. I miss him. And it also helped because journalists love alliteration, that it was Ronald Reagan and rhetoric just fell in. Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, you couldn't ask for anything more from a professional standpoint. The interesting thing is that when people looked at Reagan's rhetoric and why does the great communicator work, they only looked at his speeches. Speeches don't work unless there's an audience receptive to responding to them. There's nothing magical in words other than the word taxes. And the magic is in what comes before, higher or lower. But there isn't the magic in the words that causes people to respond. It is in the relationship of the person, the policy, the language, and people responding to that language. For a speechwriter, that's the hardest thing, of adapting ideas to an audience so that the people we want to persuade will be responded to persuade to respond positively to what we're saying, because that's the art of rhetoric, adjusting ideas to people and people to ideas, to use a phrase that Donald Bryant, one of our rhetorical theorists, used. And I think that best defines what we do. How are you able to adapt ideas to people and people to ideas? Now, generally, when we talk about audiences and audience adaptation, we have talked about adapting to the American people. That has been the standard thing. I've gone beyond that in my own work to say there are three major audiences that a president speaks to. First of all, there is the general public. When he gives a major speech on television or a press conference that is carried on television. A second audience is what I call the attentive audience, made up of journalists and people who pay attention to politics. They may not be experts in specific areas, but they are attentive to what's going on politically, especially journalists who may not know the ins and outs of policies here and there, but they are watching because they are going to be some of the people that are going to try to hold the president accountable. And a third audience is the audience of elites, policymakers, who are experts, opponents who are experts, who are going to have to make decisions, not only domestically in this country, but in foreign policy, in foreign countries as well, who are listening to presidential speeches for guidance on policy, and in fact, how they're going to respond, trying to find out what the president believes. One of the things that always bothers me as a rhetorician is to have people say, well, presidential speeches, that's just fluff to fool the public while they're really doing things behind the scenes, and that's where everything's really happening, is behind the scenes, and this is just the story publicly. The problem with that, these days, maybe that could happen in the past, but these days the problem with that is other people, not only the public is listening to speeches, but these other two audiences are. And if you're putting out a phony story just as fluff to you're going to be misleading some people who are going to be responding to what you're doing, or misleading some of your own people in your own administration. I don't know how many have read Don Regan's book, For the Record, but there's a little section in there in which he says, and I should have brought the quotation along, I never had a one-on-one conversation with President Reagan during the 4 years I was Secretary of Treasury about fiscal or economic policy or economic philosophy. I got my direction on what to do from reading his speeches and newspaper accounts of what he wanted done. Now, if you're giving a speech that's just misleading the public, you're misleading your own Secretary of the Treasury, and if it's Secretary of the Treasury with the economic changes that Reagan was trying to institute, Duck isn't having those conversations with the president, what do you think about other lower-level secretaries, Secretary of the Agriculture, who certainly is not meeting you on a day-to-day basis, or heads of agencies? Where are they getting their direction then? If Don Regan isn't getting one-on-one. Furthermore, what has happened is that you can't pull this off much anymore of fooling the public, because journalists are now using public statements as a standard of accountability for presidents. What happened with Ronald Reagan on Iran-Contra? He said, I will not trade arms for hostages in the past. Found out about Iran-Contra, what did journalists do? But immediately used that as a standard to criticize the president. What happened when the Secretary of the Treasury recommended that there be a small, I forgot what he called it, didn't want to call it tax, on savings to bail out the savings and loan? What happened? Immediately, George Bush, read my lips, no new taxes, was thrown right back to the president and the Secretary of the Treasury, and that idea was dropped, because that's become the standard. I believe that Richard Nixon was persuaded to resign because he had said he was not involved in Watergate, and then people found out, because of the June 23rd conversations, that there was some involvement in trying to get the CIA to divert the FBI's investigation. And the question became, did he lie or didn't he? That was the standard. The May 22nd statement was a standard to hold him accountable. Therefore, speech writing has become much more difficult than it was in the past, because you've got to look at all three of these audiences, know you're going to be held accountable. And it's one of the reasons why I'm now a communication expert as opposed to a speech writer, because that's too difficult for me. Let me go very quickly now to the presidents. And I should add one thing. What's become so important because of television is choosing when to go public and what forums and platform to use. Because television is the defining feature of presidential rhetoric right now. And the major question in the presidency when you decide to go public is, are we going to do it on a major speech on national television or not? That's first. And if we aren't, since those speeches ought to be used only for special occasions, you just can't go public on a prime time speech that often without diminishing the ability to go public when you really need to. You have to decide what time you're going, what forum you're going in. Are you going to go make a speech, or are you going to do it at a press conference? How are you going to handle an issue? Are you going to handle the issue? All of these things come into play when you start talking about the rhetoric. I want to focus only on two, the press conference and nationally televised speeches, and looking at the presidents, and as I say, I'm going to run through this, and then if you have questions, I'll be quite pleased to go into more detail with each of the presidents. In the past, prior to Kennedy, major way of going public was through press conferences. From their invention under Teddy Roosevelt to Franklin Roosevelt held 998 press conferences. That was his way of going public. With the introduction of television and televised press conferences, much of that has changed, and certainly television has changed, even the rhetoric. But let me look at it first in starting with Kennedy, because he was much more traditional than some of the presidents who came after him, although he did introduce live televised press conferences. He only gave 9 television speeches to the American people in his 2.5 years in office. Only 9. He had 66 televised press conferences. That tells you something about how he was going public. He relied more on the press conference and the traditional way of going public through the press than other presidents. Secondly, his rhetoric was essentially a crisis rhetoric. Theodore Sorensen, in his book on Kennedy, lists no less than 15 major crises in the first 8 months that Kennedy was in office. There's just a list, 15 major crises. It was a crisis presidency. And when you think of the Kennedy administration, what do you think of? Right away, Cuban Missile Crisis, right? The Berlin Crisis, the steel crisis, the civil rights crisis of 1963. It was a crisis presidency. Now, I say that as a generalization because in Kennedy's rhetoric, the important choice was whether to make an issue a crisis issue or not. During his first 2 years, issues that came up were essentially foreign policy issues that he made crisis issues, from the Berlin Crisis of 1963 on through to the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1961, excuse me, to the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. And in between the steel crisis and a variety of the crisis in the Congo and so on. What occurred in the third year was a move away from crisis rhetoric in foreign policy, starting with the American University address as a prelude to the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, in which he sought to move away from his own crisis rhetoric and toward a period of detente and more normal relations with the Soviet Union on the Test Ban Treaty. Interestingly enough, on the major domestic issue facing us during the Kennedy administration, civil rights, Kennedy did not define that during the first 2 years as a crisis issue, but as a legal issue to be handled legally, as he said in his speech after the Meredith incident in 1962 at the University of Mississippi. Whereas in the third year, Kennedy moved to seeing civil rights as a crisis issue, just the reverse of the way in which he handled major issues on foreign policy. In fact, as I look at the Kennedy administration, you have almost two administrations, at least from a rhetorical standpoint, an administration of the first 2 years in which foreign policy was crisis, 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 and civil rights was an issue that he really didn't want to deal with except legally. And the third year in which we moved toward the introduction of detente and the crisis of civil rights. Let me move quickly to Lyndon Johnson. Johnson didn't want to compete with the memory of John F. Kennedy's press conferences. In fact, of course, he takes office on November 22nd. It is not, I should have gotten the exact date, I think until February, that he holds his first televised press conference. And he was very nervous, and I should have brought the quotation from Scotty Reston. The best that can be said about this is that he made it through it. Instead, what Johnson did was use televised speeches to the American people, going directly to them. In his first year in office, counting some of his interruptions of TV shows and so forth to tell the American people what strike he settled today, I counted 10 times that President Johnson went on national TV to talk to the American people. 10 times. That's more than Kennedy had in the entire time he was in office. Johnson saw making the speech to the American people and going to them to set an agenda and explain what he was doing as his more effective way of gathering public support than the press conference. And indeed, as we know from the Harvard Commission under Johnson, the press conference became a very unimportant thing. He held a number of them. I think he held 126, 127 press conferences, but very rarely did he announce, with the exception of a July 28, 1965 press conference, did he announce anything of importance. He quit going public in 1965. In the sense of making these speeches to the American people over national television, because he really burned it out. Here is the problem of presidential rhetoric. When the Dominican Republic crisis broke out in late April of 1965, Lyndon Johnson went on television 3 times in 5 days to explain what he was doing there. And the first two, he broke into regularly scheduled programming without any preparation for the audience. Some of us sitting there watching TV that evening. All of a sudden, Lyndon Johnson comes on to say we're sending troops into the Dominican Republic. Because of the criticism he got, he tried to use what various people have called the Johnson treatment, private Johnson treatment, to the American people, went on TV 2 days later, went on and broke into regular programming, went on TV a third time, 2 days later, with a long speech that was a disaster, quite frankly, because of some mechanical problems and other problems, 3 times in 5 days. And he got so criticized for doing that, as well as for the policy intervention from the liberal press, that Johnson felt he was burnt out on it. And thus, when it came time to announce the escalation of the war in Vietnam in late July 1965, here was his chance to get public support at the outset. Instead of doing it with a major speech to the American people announcing why we're going into Vietnam, here was the opportunity to justify policy. Instead, he did it at a 12 noon press conference with a small audience, and lost whatever opportunity I believe he had for gaining the support that would be necessary for the long commitment that he was engaging the American people in. The third president, Richard Nixon, gave 37 televised speeches to the American public and held 39 press conferences. That tells you where his priorities were. Furthermore, at his first press conference, he said press conferences are not a place to make policy in an off-the-cuff manner. and made the press conference an ordeal that he had to go through, and an unimportant part of going public. Richard Nixon went public to the American people directly. That was always his audience. Beginning at the outset, even before he took the presidency, took over the presidency, on December 8, 1968, President Nixon held a schedule, a half-hour special television show written, hosted, produced by Richard Nixon. I don't know how many would remember what he did that night. Introduced his entire cabinet. Introduced his entire cabinet on that evening, and there you could see what Richard Nixon intended to do. He was going to the American people directly over the heads of Congress, over the heads of journalists, to get public support. And I think there were good political reasons for doing that, in that he was only elected by 43.4% of the vote. He had to expand his constituency. His model of going president, going public, is very much different than the model of Kennedy, who was using the press conferences as a way of going public, letting the press then disseminate information and interpret what he was doing. Nixon was going right over their heads, President Nixon was, directly to the American people to get his message across in undiluted fashion. And for 4 years was very effective at doing that until Watergate scandals diminished that power and indeed led to the resignation of the president. Ford and Carter, I can lump together so we can move on. Both were rhetorical failures for one reason or another. Neither very adept at speaking, period. But in the case of Carter, at least James Fallow says this, Carter didn't think speeches were important. He thought results were important, that if he did the right thing, that the American people would naturally support him. And his speeches reflect that. They are more like reports to the American people. In fact, sometimes they're more like reports to a board of directors with a listing of 10 points here, and he loved to give speeches in lists. The speech, first speech on the energy crisis in April of 1977 has a list of 10 principles that are going to guide the energy policy. Can you imagine, I don't know how many of you may have listened to that speech and fell asleep during part of it, but you start listing 10 things in a speech, and by the time you get to the sixth, you've forgotten what the first one was, unless you're taking notes, and not too many people take notes on presidential speeches. And when you make your major, as he called it, the cornerstone of our energy policy, the sixth in a list of 10, it's going to get lost. And that's, conservation was the cornerstone, and it's sixth in the middle, and he goes on then to 7, 8, 9, 10. By the time you got to 10, you've forgotten what the cornerstone was, unless you listened carefully or listened to the analysis afterwards. He followed that by saying, I believe it was a list of 7 goals that we had now in the energy policy. So you had 17 things to remember from a speech. You can do that perhaps with a essay. You could perhaps do that in a report. But if you're listening to a speech, being able to remember 3 things is about the extent of what we're able to remember. Furthermore, the timing of his speeches, Carter's speeches, was not good. Very effective in press conferences for journalists, very effective, for the very reasons that he was ineffective in speeches. Carter understood issues and the details of issues probably as well as any president of recent times, and could talk with detail about issues. Almost every issue under the sun, if you believe some of the people who have written about him, even the issue of who should use the White House tennis courts. And that was very effective for journalists who want to get information, who want to get to the president's thinking. That was very effective for journalists. And it was also affected in a press conference where you have a number of different issues. It can go from, as you know, from foreign affairs to domestic affairs, from very important issues to very minor issues. And if Sarah McClendon asked a good question, then you're going to have an issue that maybe even Carter couldn't have the details on. Carter had a position, according to Fallows, on every issue under the sun. But according to Fallows also, as a speechwriter, he didn't have an overall philosophy that tied them all together. And therefore that, if that's true, that served him very well in press conferences where he could respond to specific things. But in a speech where everything has to be tied together so that people can see the overall thrust, it worked against him. Finally, President Reagan is a third model for going public. The Reagan administration walked in and said, "We understand the new presidency. It's a rhetorical presidency. Rhetoric is a source of power, and we want to use that well and effectively." And indeed, David Gergen, in the transition period, and a group that he assembled, began to work on that very problem of what the president does in the first 100 days and how rhetoric can fit into it, and presented a report to the president on mistakes that could be needed to be avoided and what happens in the first 100 days that affects the rest of the administration, and they had an emphasis on rhetoric. Rhetoric became central in the Reagan administration. This is testified to by a variety of people who have written on it. They understood that. The rhetoric then was developed as an absolute instrument of power. I don't think one could call any of Reagan's speeches, other than perhaps some of the ceremonial speeches, eloquent. I think the speech after the Challenger tragedy was very moving. I think the speech at Moscow last year was a very good speech. But other than the line, "Evil Empire," is there anything comparable to "Ask not what you can do for what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country," from the Reagan administration and 8 years from the great communicator? Is there anything comparable to "The only thing we have to fear is fear itself," from the 8 years of the Reagan administration? Instead, rhetoric became an instrument of policy. And let me just conclude by talking about the first year. President Reagan went into the presidency and in his first speech set the agenda for the year, first major speech, February 5th, on the economic problem facing us. No talk about foreign affairs. The agenda is the economic problem facing us. And that there are four problems we have. It was what we call straight problem solving public speaking. Four problems. Taxes are too high. We're spending too much money in government. Too many regulations, and we don't have a sound and stable fiscal policy. He said, those are the things that have caused the economic mess that we're facing. He said, I'm going to come back in 2 weeks and present to Congress the way to solve these problems. Now, what he had done is set the agenda for the year, limited the agenda. He or his advisors or in connection had understood the limitations on the office of president of the presidency, that is a very weak office, the weakest of our three branches of government, and therefore knew that they had to limit their agenda and focus everything on that. He came back February 18th, speech to a joint session of Congress. So I've told you what the problems are, and the solutions were rather self-evident. The problems hired. Taxes are too high, lower the taxes. The problem we're spending too much, cut spending. Too many regulations, cut regulations. Standard problem solution speech. For the remainder of that year, that was the focus, getting that through. The president did not give a speech on foreign policy until November 18th, when he introduced the START program. and was the only major speech on foreign policy in the first 2 years because the focus was solely on domestic policy and specifically on economic problems. And the major speeches then were to control the agenda, do it in a simple problem-solving fashion in which the speeches are tied together by consistency of themes, which is the way in which you get beyond the problem that Carter faced of not tying issues together. And indeed, the president could on occasion even shift policy and still use the same theme within the speeches, which is a technique that speechwriters use in campaigns of being able to tie all of the things that we are advocating in the campaign to the overall thematic approach to the campaign. And it worked because people were hurting in 1981, because inflation was up, no one likes taxes, and here was the audience adaptation. The rhetoric of Ronald Reagan worked in 1981 because it adapted to the needs of people. And they responded not because they necessarily believed in his economic policies. Some did, some didn't. But they wanted relief from the inflation that was crushing them. They wanted relief from the interest rates that were crushing them. And nobody likes taxes, and he promised to lower them. And thus, he became the great communicator because there was a match in 1981 between the man, the ideas, and the circumstances that people felt or were experiencing that caused them to be receptive to the arguments he was making. I stress that because in 1982, he came back with a new federalism program that went nowhere and certainly was not a success. That's a mild way to put it. That what happened in the first year was because the audience was not receptive. Not that they opposed it, they just didn't care about transferring all of these programs from federal government to local government, and local officials didn't want to have to raise taxes to pay for them if they got transferred to local officials. You can see a total difference between the first and the second year, which gets back to this adjusting ideas to people and people's ideas. The Reagan administration, the first 4 years, is a postgraduate seminar. And I just touched on a few things here. A postgraduate seminar and the uses that and throw it open to questions.
Who'd like to ask the first question?
Sir?
Yes,
sir. As a result of what you say, isn't Ronald Reagan one of the most popular presidents we ever had in the United States? Certainly judged by the rugged test of the votes he got in his two campaigns.
One most popular person.
Yeah, person.
Yes, I think that. And you can't leave out, I don't think one should leave out, the assassination attempt and the way in which he handled it. This gets back to this point of ethos that I was talking about before. When he made those first proposals for tax cuts and budget cuts, they began to attack President Reagan as a Scrooge, who dealt unfair to certain segments of society, particularly people who are powerless. Once the assassination attempt occurred in March, and we saw the president even walking in the hospital, and then the two jokes that he supposedly, or I'm sure did, say in the hospital itself, you couldn't attack him personally after that. That issue was totally removed. You could not. And I think many of us had our attitudes and perceptions of Reagan changed because of that nearly tragic incident. And I think that is part of what began to flame the liking of the man. Also, he seems to be a genuinely likable person.
I mean, he had a magnetic personality along with everything else.
He was different in, I think, from
Richard Nixon, and that Nixon, and it's part of the rhetoric, Nixon polarized. I'm giving a speech at the International Association of Psychohistorians on Nixon and a way of analyzing Nixon's rhetoric as a psychological way of understanding how he functioned. Nixon had to see things always, partially because he was a debater, and debaters divide issues into pro and con, and you argue one side or the other. Always had to have someone to argue against and to attack. We had the vocal minority and a variety of other domestic foes who were attacking that way. You notice in Ronald Reagan's rhetoric, never attacked anyone personally. Special interest was the phrase always used to describe his opponents. Special interest rather than the radical liberals, which was Agnew's phrase in 1970 in attacking the Democrats. And I think that served him very well. It's a very adroit rhetorical move, because then you can name anything you want as special interest. And it has such a bad connotation, special interest, versus the president, who always represents the public interest. And if you got the choice between special interest and the public interest, which one are you going to take? And of course, then you can apply it selectively wherever you want. But it doesn't mean you're attacking people. Calling them radical liberals or other kinds of phrases that were attached to them. And I think that was very appropriate for him to do that, or very effective and adroit for him to do that.
Next question. Yes, previous comment.
To what extent do you think that President Reagan was personally responsible for defining what you call this postgraduate course in rhetoric?
That's a hard thing to untangle. Certainly he had made his political career on speeches, from that speech in 1964 supporting Barry Goldwater, which made him a national figure. He had a whole history of speaking before that, which I think is more important than his movie career, quite frankly, and the kind of president he was. He had, in the first administration, very able people in the communications end with David Gergen and Michael Lever, who understood the rhetorical presidency. And because of his delegation of power, as we know from all a variety of other areas, I assume he delegated power to them. But from what I hear, he was the one that had a sense of when you go and make a speech, when it's needed, and then they would work out the details where specifically. So I think it was a collaboration of people who understood what he wanted and were very talented in helping him achieve it in the rhetorical dimension.
This is possibly a follow-up on that, but a little broader. In the various administrations that we covered here, was the program, as finally evolved, done on an ad hoc basis, or was there a deliberate agenda set up in as a generality?
That's a good question. It seems in the, well, Kennedy administration was done on an ad hoc basis because they were responding. They had the Bay of Pigs fiasco in April, on 3 months after being in. They had to respond and defend the president on that. Then they had the meeting with Khrushchev in Vienna in June, and the Berlin crisis starts to emerge out of that, and they're responding to that. Then the steel crisis, when U.S. Steel raised its prices by $6 a ton, and Kennedy wasn't going to tolerate that, and responding to that. Then you had the Cuban Missile Crisis. There was a lot of response. In fact, the first 2 years of the Kennedy administration were pretty much reactive to events. With Johnson, they began to plan some more in the third year. I think they were growing, the administration was growing in the presidency. With Johnson, some of it was planned. hard to say about President Johnson, because he could do things on, he was very instinctive and could do things on the spur of the moment at times. He had a sense of putting speeches within his legislative priorities and using them to achieve the kinds of things he wanted to achieve legislatively, but his great skill, of course, was his own knowledge of how Congress works and his ability to get things to happen. With Richard Nixon, it was planned. Starting approximately in September of the first year, there was a plan to go public, but they really didn't work out how to do it until, if you believe Jeb Stuart Magruder in his book, when he came in and started to use what he calls the rifle rather than the shotgun approach to speeches, so that they were targeted and they knew what they were doing. And of course, with Watergate, and then he was on the defensive and responding, and everything's out of control by that time. But the next 3 years of the Nixon administration were very carefully scripted, if you will. With Ford, the circumstances, he came into the presidency in a short period of time. There was not that kind of planning. I do have his campaign book for 1976, in which they, of course, plot it all out as consultants doing the campaign. Carter administration tried to plot it out, but it appears to me President Carter had underestimated greatly the power of speeches. And frequently they were done on an ad hoc basis. And remember the Malay speech in July, in which he was going to give a speech and then canceled it and went up for 10 days to Camp David, brought all kinds of people to tell him to talk to him, then came down and wrote a different, gave a different speech altogether. The Reagan administration, no question. No question, the first 4 years. Carefully scripted. First 2 years, there is only one foreign policy speech because they were concentrating on domestic concerns. As soon as that off-term election is over with, they switch to foreign policy and defense matters. And those become the topics in the third year because that's the area of presidential prerogative. You can control an agenda in foreign policy in the third year because that's a prerogative of the president. And you just see an absolute change. The topics now become speech on MX missile, speech on increased defense spending, playing right off of START, and then of course we have the KAL shoot down. Foreign policy becomes the dominant theme. Domestic issues are handled on speeches to special to constituency groups, but not national televised speeches.
Okay. Before television and before investigative reporting, it seems to me, as I've read, that the presidents, when they wanted something done, got together with Congress, either through deals or directly through persuasion, and got it done that way. Since then, as you pointed out, they've gone to the public. Are we seeing now, as a pattern, that the president, whenever he has something to, he wants done that he thinks will have trouble with Congress, that as a routine matter now, he'll go public and try to get public support and thereby influence the Congress?
3 months ago, I would have said yes. Absolutely, unqualified. And I'm surprised by what President Bush is doing. He has the one speech he's given, nationally televised State of the Union address. He didn't want to call it that. And no televised speeches since then. I think it's going to depend on the political context in which you find yourself. Certainly, President Bush will move to this. I was surprised he didn't set an agenda for this year. But yes, this will happen. But President Bush faces both houses of Congress controlled by the Democrats, and therefore going public could be counterproductive right now at the outset of his administration. And given the problems that exist, plus his management style of seeking cooperation with Congress, I think we will see him go public later on, yes, but not now. I'm surprised he hasn't now.
First, I wanted to compliment you on your remarks. I can see why you have 600 students that were superbly organized. This is the neatest page of notes I think I've ever taken. Very easy to follow and very clear. I wanted to ask you about nonverbal rhetoric. You mentioned that Ronald Reagan didn't coin any ringing phrases. Most of the phrases I remember are lines from movies. Made My Day and The Force Is With Us, and even The Evil Empire is a sort of a veiled reference to Star Wars. But Ronald Reagan's nonverbal rhetoric, his campaign ads, the backdrops that he chose for his speeches, like the Statue of Liberty and the one that backfired, Bitburg, the film tribute to Nancy at the convention, and the photographs of him chopping wood with his shirt off, it seemed to me all these current exchange rates were worth 1,000 words. And I wondered if you could comment on the sort of the development of nonverbal rhetoric and use of television and images to persuade.
I always have a problem with nonverbal. I say, yes, I'll deal with that, but I'm going to deal with it in a nonverbal way if you don't mind. Presidents have frequently in the past chosen symbolic settings to make major announcements. And this has been a standard. We become more aware of it because of television. But when Mr. Truman wanted to announce the Marshall Plan or have it announced by General Marshall, General Marshall went to Harvard and was there. College setting has been a symbolic place where the president announces or a representative announces a major change in policy because of all the symbolism that is attached there, of a learning experience of opening your mind to different ideas. It's an appropriate thing to do. With television, people now, or people in the administration, have to worry about the environment in which speeches are given, major speeches are given. Have to worry very much about that. So that, because the audience has changed, when presidents used to give speeches, the audience was the people gathered, plus the journalists who would carry the message to other people. The audience now is the TV camera on a major speech that carries the president's words right out to the public. Therefore, the symbolic setting becomes very important in reinforcing the message that is being presented to the public. Bitburg was a poor choice because it directly contradicted the kind of message that Tripp was intending, or not contradicted, but undermined the message that the president's trip was intended to convey to Europeans. It's a very important thing finding that, but what has to happen there, like in everything else, and I've only touched on really the rhetorical, the dynamics of this, it all has to be coordinated so that there's a consistent nonverbal, verbal message being sent out to the public. I think the theater background is becoming more valuable now in rhetoric and starting to understand some of the nonverbal and the setting and environmental parts of a rhetorical effort. I'm not sure that I answered directly to one comment.
Well, no, you did. I think the verbal and the nonverbal have to agree or the nonverbal doesn't work. It just seems to me that when I remember Ronald Reagan's press conferences, I don't remember anything he said. I just remember the way he would look at the press. Especially Sam Johnson, it was, didn't I tell you to clean up your room? Didn't I already told you this? It was this utter disdain, and it just spoke volumes to people, I thought. And the Bear in the Woods commercial, it was a commercial that ran in 1984, and it didn't have any human beings in it, but was a doctrine on foreign policy. And my students, at least, many of whom have grown up with the image as well as the word in their educations, are clued into this. And I think they responded to Ronald Reagan because he was clued into it too.
Let me have two responses to that. One, the president has to find the format that's he's most comfortable with and works best. Press conferences were not Ronald Reagan's best form. Mm-hmm. What he was to the American people was, mm-hmm. and that's why it worked so well. The second thing on symbolism, I'll just revert back to Governor Thornburg's campaign in 1978. Our original speeches, major policy speeches, what he was going to issue speeches, excuse me, that he was going to make his issues were given at a certain location, a hotel downtown Pittsburgh. Until we got to the problem of roads and bridges in Pennsylvania. And for that speech, we really didn't even give the speech. We handed out as a position paper, although it was written as a speech. And we went to the Thornburg Bridge, which is falling down in Pittsburgh. We could have chosen a lot of others, but the Thornburg Bridge was our bridge.
Are you and Mike really saying, in a sense, that unless somebody is good at theater, unless somebody is good at nonverbal, unless they're really willing, and you remember Dick Darman in our commission kept talking about this, really willing to do retakes, as apparently Reagan was, and to have all the preparation that Darman described for his press conference, that a president is not going to be successful unless all these things are true?
I think it is an important part of the presidency now that can enhance the power of the presidency, or the president. And that presidents have to take it into account to find where they can't become an actor in the sense that Ronald Reagan had that background. But television has made all of us, to a degree, actors in public drama. And what you have to find, like any actor, is the most comfortable persona. And as long as the people can perceive it as authentic, it does not have to be polished. The important thing is being authentic, and having an authentic person come through on television, rather than a person acting. And I think that's where people would get into problems, politicians get into problems, when they try in the public forum to act someone other than who they are. But certainly, with television and all the other things that make up instantaneous communication now, the public side of the presidency is a major side in the exercise of power.
And to use Jane Pauley's words, or David Brinkley, we're running out of time, but if Victor and Nancy can make a one-sentence question, why, maybe we can do it.
It's a challenge. I was thinking of your statement in relationship to the presidency, the executive branch, was the third weakest branch of government. It surprised me a little bit. If you said second, I probably would have felt more comfortable. But when you take the presidency through President Jackson, President Lincoln, perhaps Theodore Roosevelt, maybe not Wilson, but Franklin Delano Roosevelt, how they expanded the role of the presidency, the power they had through the appointment process, delegation of authority, ambassadorial thing, would you still think that's not an effective and maybe a stronger role than what the Constitution provides for them?
I think that the presidency is weaker than the courts or Congress. Ronald Reagan is a very popular president, had public support for himself, and start looking at what his agenda was in the campaign of 1980, campaign of 1984, and what got passed. And the list is not that long. It's surprising. Congress delegated power to Franklin Roosevelt because of the Depression, and it was able to expand. But it remains an extremely, it seems to me, a weak office. As President Taft, in his lectures here at the University of Virginia in 1980,
16, remarked about or contrasted the parliamentary system with our system, and remarked to great extent about the weakness of the presidency. The one that most struck me, and which has been a theme that I've played off here today, was our president has no initiative in respect to legislation given him by law, except that of mere recommendation, and no legal or formal method of entering into the argument and discussion of the proposed legislation while pending in Congress, even though, I'm gonna stop right there. I believe that the office is weak. I never bought the idea of the imperial presidency. I thought instead that a set of presidents had extended power in certain areas where it was perhaps inappropriate. And I thought that in response to that, things like the War Powers Act were intrusions upon presidential power and weakening the presidency. I don't know that I want to, since time is running out, to make the whole argument there. I would merely make it in terms of what presidents want to do and how little they achieve.
Nancy, one sentence question.
Just what do you recommend, what do you think the future holds for us? How long does Bush have to be conciliatory? Or how fast do you think he has to move now to get the rhetoric started in the one solid direction?
If interest rates keep going up, if inflation goes up, he's going to have to act quickly, because it is part of our psychology that we give presidents too much credit when things go well and much too much blame when things go poorly. I think it very much depends on how the economy goes. And he is going, what I read in the Post this morning about interest rates going up. We start to go into some of those hard times, he's going to have to act.
I know others. Well, all right, one last.
Do you believe that the effectiveness of the dialogue of any president can be enhanced or diluted by the spokesman for the free network?
Yes. Yes. That's why they don't like to have afternoon press conferences and have their words. We had a letter from President Carter, wasn't it? He said he changed from the 4 o'clock press conference to the primetime press conference because he didn't like what was being reported at 6 o'clock. Yes.
I know all of you joined me in thanking Ted Wendt. I think Mike Cornfield said it all. We have some notion, at least, why Ted Wendt has 600 students after this performance.